From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We've come upon the pharmacy right across the from the General Hospital in Port-au-Prince. And there's a body laying in the road. I don't know if it's a pharmacist, a doctor, a nurse, one of the patients. One of the people here who lives right in the neighborhood said it's a doctor. This is the major pharmacy where people come to get their medicines. And they say there are many more that are buried inside. We just saw a head and some fingers in the rubble. We're right across from the hospital where there are more than 10,000 U.S. soldiers. This is Haiti.
As a powerful aftershock hits Haiti, we'll get a report from Amy Goodman in Port-au-Prince. Hundreds of thousands of people are still without food or shelter. We'll also take a look at the Guantanamo suicides, how the Bush and Obama administrations have covered up the murders of three prisoners at a secret black site facility in 2006. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Anjali Kamath. Haiti has been hit with a powerful new earthquake just over a week after the initial quake that killed tens of thousands of people. The latest aftershock hit just after 6 a.m. this morning, registering 6.1 on the Richter scale. Thousands of people were seen flooding the streets of Port-au-Prince, but it remains unclear what damage the new quake may have caused. The quake struck as the official death toll hit 70,000, but it's widely estimated the actual toll could top 200,000 and even higher. Relief efforts have yet to approach meeting the dire humanitarian needs. In a statement, the medical relief group Partners in Health said some 20,000 people are dying each day who could be saved by surgery. The World Food Program says it's handed out more than 250,000 ready-to-eat food rations amidst estimates some 3 million people are in need. The agency says it needs to hand out 100 million food rations in the next month, but it's on pace to have only 16 million available. Earthquake survivors continue to receive medical care in makeshift clinics around Haiti. In a video release, Doctors Without Borders anesthetist Dean Marchaban described the magnitude of the amputations being performed.
I imagine that not since the Crimean War have surgeons seen and amputated so many limbs, perhaps the Civil War in the United States. But we're talking about a situation that I've certainly never seen in my experience.
Military presence continues to rise in Haiti. On Tuesday, hundreds of new U.S. troops arrived in Port-au-Prince, bringing the total U.S. contingent to upwards of 11,000. The U.N. Security Council has also authorized a new deployment of some 3,500 additional troops. On Tuesday, desperately needed aid began reaching residents of Léogâne, the epicenter of last week's earthquake. Earthquake survivors flocked around Marines handing out supplies from a helicopter.
We're trying to help these people out as far as food and water, you know, supply that they medical supply that they need. They're all complaining that, you know, all their houses, they're right now living out in the street. They got no water, no food.
We'll have more from Haiti after headlines. In Massachusetts, Republican Scott Brown has won an upset victory over Democrat Martha Coakley in a special election for the Senate seat vacated by the late Edward Kennedy. Brown's victory will leave Democrats in nominal control of 59 seats, one short of the 60 needed to overcome Republican filibusters. The result could immediately derail President Obama's push for health care reform, which Kennedy described as the cause of his life. Addressing cheering supporters, Brown said he would vote against the current legislation.
One thing is very, very clear as I travel throughout the state. People do not want the trillion-dollar health care plan that is being forced that is being forced on the American people. And this bill is not being debated openly and fairly. It will raise taxes. It will raise taxes. It will hurt Medicare. It will destroy jobs and run our nation deeper into debt.
In addition to his stance on health care reform, Brown has voiced support for the torture technique known as waterboarding on foreign prisoners and has also opposed a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants unless they first leave the United States. Coakley began the race as a heavy favorite, but was criticized for what some characterized as a lackluster campaign. In her concession speech, Coakley invoked the words of the late Senator Kennedy.
Okay, so this is the deal. Although our campaign ends tonight, we know that our mission continues and our work goes on. I am heartbroken at the result, and I know that you are also.
The Supreme Court has thrown out a lower court ruling ordering a new sentencing for the journalist and former Black Panther Mumia Abu-Jamal. The decision orders the Third U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia to revisit its ruling that Jamal deserves a new sentencing because of flawed jury instructions. The Supreme Court cited its own recent decision in an Ohio death row case it says raises similar issues. Abu-Jamal was convicted for the 1981 killing of a white police officer following a controversial trial before a predominantly white jury. Abu-Jamal contends the case was marred with racial bias, including the deliberate exclusion of blacks from the jury. If resentenced, Abu-Jamal will face either death or life in prison without parole. Eight people are dead following a shooting spree Tuesday in Virginia. Police say they believe they've cornered the suspect in an area near the crime scene. An American-educated Pakistani woman has gone on trial on charges of trying to kill U.S. personnel in Afghanistan. Afia Siddiqui is accused of trying to open fire on several FBI agents who had come to question her. The FBI also says she had documents on making chemical bombs and a list of potential targets in the United States. But she's only being charged for the shooting incident. Afghan witnesses say U.S. personnel shot Siddiqui following a misunderstanding that saw her initially asking them for help. Siddiqui herself was not the only person shot during the incident with the agents. On Tuesday, Siddiqui was removed from the courtroom after yelling out that she had been tortured at a secret prison during her captivity. Outside the courtroom, a group of supporters picketed the trial.
And that's what the judge appealed to the judge. Go by the book. We don't need any favor being a Muslim, being a woman. No. Go by the book. The values of this country. Not be afraid of that some guy is a terrorist. Some guy is Al-Qaeda, some guy is a Taliban. His time is over. Bush is over.
Siddiqui disappeared in March 2003, just weeks after the FBI announced it sought her for questioning. There has been speculation she was captured by Pakistani troops and jailed at the U.S.-run Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. And the Israeli government has deported an American journalist after detaining him last week. The journalist, Jared Malson, is the English-language editor for the Palestinian Ma'an News Agency. He was detained after Israeli customs officials blocked him from entering Israel and deemed him a security threat. In a statement, the International Federation of Journalists criticized what it called, quote, an intolerable violation of press freedom. It added, quote, the ban of entry in this case appears to be as a reprisal measure for the journalist's independent reporting, and that is unacceptable. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz, meanwhile, is reporting the Israeli government has stopped granting work visas for most foreign non-governmental organizations in the occupied territories. Israel is now only authorizing tourist visas, which bar the NGO employees from working. The groups affected include Oxfam, Save the Children, and Doctors Without Borders. In Afghanistan, a new survey estimates Afghans have paid around $2.5 billion in bribes over the past year. The figure amounts to nearly one quarter of Afghans' gross national product. According to the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, more than half the Afghan population reported paying a bribe to an Afghan official last year. And the Pentagon says it will investigate a Michigan-based military contractor found to have stamped Bible verse references on combat rifle sites used by U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. The firm, Trijicon, has been criticized for possibly violating laws barring proselytizing by U.S. troops. The references are stamped on equipment allowing troops to see enemies in the dark of night. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Anjali Kamath with Amy Goodman in Haiti. 1 week after Haiti suffered the worst earthquake in over 200 years, Port-au-Prince was hit by a strong aftershock this morning. Initial reports said the latest quake measured 6.1 on the Richter scale, one of the strongest aftershocks since the 7.0 magnitude quake crippled this country 8 days ago. While tens of thousands of the wounded await medical help, the survivors are still burying the dead. The death toll is now estimated at a staggering 200,000. Some 3 million Haitians, a third of the country's population, have been directly affected by the quake, with 1.5 million now homeless. Amy Goodman filed this report from Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Just arrived at the General Hospital here in Port-au-Prince in the capital of Haiti, the main hospital for Port-au-Prince. And the U.S. soldiers have also just arrived, more than 10,000 of them. It's causing chaos because people who are taking care of their families, who've been operated on, who are waiting to be operated on, who go to get their only means of sustenance, perhaps food or water, they're trying to get in. And now, for the first time, they're not able to, or they're having trouble. We're going to see if we can get in right now. How old are you?
19.
Is this your first tour of duty?
Yes, ma'am.
How come the tripod?
Helps for set it down. It's a little heavy. So whenever I do set it down, it makes it a little easier.
What kind of gun is it?
It's a fully automatic.
That's a lot of bullets you
have. Yeah, we're not going to use them, though. Only if we have to.
We're going in to see Dr. Evan Lyon of Partners in Health, an organization that has 10 clinics throughout Haiti and many more around the world. And Haiti has more than 4,000 employees.
We tried to get in, the soldier said, no press.
That was not a mandate from anybody, but we do need crowd control. There's no insecurity. We need some crowd control so that the patients are not kept from having access. To this point, the military has not been here. They showed up about half an hour ago for the first time. This is the main general hospital for the country. This is the main academic hospital for the country. This is the most important medical center in Haiti. It has been given very slow capacity. We've been improvising for the last 4 days on the ground with the Ministry of Health under the direction of the Haitian director, and with our own meager capacity. The international volunteers are doing good work, but this place has been largely ignored. You see the infrastructure as it's been destroyed. And in terms of supplies, in terms of surgeons, in terms of aid relief, the response has been incredibly slow. There are teams of surgeons that have been sent to places that were, quote, more secure, that have 10 or 20 doctors and 10 patients. We have 1,000 people on this campus that are triaged and ready for surgery, but we only have 4 working ORs without anesthesia, without pain medications. We're still struggling to get ourselves up to 24-hour care.
Where is the nurse's building, the most hard hit, and tell us what happened?
The nurse's building is behind here on the campus. I can show you later. It's a 4 or 5 story building that collapsed entirely. The entire class of second year nursing students was inside. We think it was between 100 and 150 people, 100 to 150 nurses who were buried inside. Some of the stench is coming from there directly. The other thing that's worth knowing is behind us is the morgue, the main morgue for the city. Bodies were piled here by the thousands. They're being moved by front end loader and pickup and dump truck. They've largely been cleared, but the morgue even to now has had no refrigeration. So this place has been very dense with dying and very dense with suffering.
There are now, I think it was announced, 12,000 U.S. soldiers. The Venezuelan President Chavez called it an occupation now. What would you say?
I think it has real potential to be an occupation. If there are 12,000 soldiers here, it is an occupation. I've not known of any violence at the hands of the American military. We've also just barely had the beginning of collaboration with them, literally within the last 30 minutes. General Keane, their operations person, finally showed up here after some time, and the military is helping us secure the grounds. But of course, this is an occupation. This is a disaster area. Warm bodies help, but military is potentially very destructive in this environment.
What do you need? What would be constructive?
What we need right now is electricity, water, nurses, surgeons, and materials. We have on site right now, we have 7 operating rooms up and running. We need about 15 or 20 within the next 24 hours. We have materials to keep the operating rooms going for maybe another 12 hours. Once that runs out, then we're stuck.
Soldiers haven't brought you supplies?
Not yet.
Talk about the most pressing problems of people here, dare I say, the crushing need, and what has happened in this first week, the people who have died, the people who could have lived.
The most pressing need is for surgery. Most of the injuries were crushing injuries, were bones. There are hundreds of people here with compound fractures, meaning the bone has broken and come out the skin. They've had first aid. They've been stabilized. They're being given antibiotics. And some are dying of infection. What what they need is surgery, and they need it right away. Those people are dying minute to minute to minute because we don't have the surgical capacity to take care of their wounds, to decompress the infections. The other thing that weighs heavy on me is that we have no pain medicines. So we have people now, we're approaching exactly 1 week in a few hours. We've had people with compound fractures. We've had people with limbs that need amputation, and we have no analgesia. We have no pain medicines of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
His arm was cut when it was broken at school.
This question of security and the rumors of security and the racism behind the idea of security has been our major block to getting aid in. The U.S. military has promised us for several days to bring in machinery, but they've been listening to this idea that things are insecure and so we don't have supplies. I'm living here in the neighborhood with a friend. I'm staying with some of my Haitian doctor colleagues. We've been circulating on the roads to 1 and 2 in the morning, moving patients, moving supplies, trying to get our work done. There is no security. The UN is not out. The US is not out. The Haitian police are not able to be out. But there is also no insecurity. I don't know if you guys were out late last night, but you can hear a pin drop in this city. It's a peaceful place. There is no war. There is no crisis except the suffering that's ongoing. The concern for militarization, the concern for occupation is very real. There is capacity that we don't have that the military will help us with, and that is urgently needed because we're losing patients minute to minute. But the first thing that listeners need to understand is that there is no insecurity here. There has not been, and I expect there will not be. Let's go into the operating rooms to show you what we don't have. Beginning on Thursday, this has been our main operating capacity. There are 4 tables. We have good doctors, we have good nurses, and we have very few supplies. At this point, like I was saying, we have perhaps 12 hours of working materials to keep going. In these operating rooms, we don't have oxygen, we don't have general anesthesia, we don't have narcotic pain medicines in enough quantity. People are getting major surgery, amputations, bones reset, decompression, fasciotomies for crush injuries to release the pressure in the muscle. Under anesthesia with a drug called ketamine that works great for the surgery, but when it stops. There's no pain control. We have been operating around the clock by daylight when we have it, by flashlights when we don't have it. We still do not have electricity in this building. Most of the injuries, about 80% of the injuries, are orthopedic injuries, and we do not have orthopedic supplies. We have literally gone to the hardware store and bought hacksaws to do amputations, and that's the best we can do right now. This is our triage and pre-op area. Again, we have over 1,000 patients that are ready for surgery. We just lack the capacity to get it done. Let's walk down to the post-op ward. Come inside. This was the emergency room for the hospital. The operating suites are destroyed. This was the emergency room. Less than 24 hours ago, this was an empty building. No bed, no people, no staff, no nursing, no patients. Currently, this is our post-op care area. When we get the materials, this will be our ICU. But please remember, less than 24 hours, there was nothing here, and we'll walk through. Much of the staffing has come from the Haitian diaspora, Haitian Americans who've come down to assist. They hit the ground running, and they've been working all night and ever since with language capacity, with compassion, and with dedication to work in these conditions. But let's look. This was an empty building less than 24 hours ago, and now we're working.
My name is Chantal Cesaire. I'm a registered nurse. I'm from Boston. I came to help because I felt that if all the time we talked about helping Haiti, this is the time. And this is it's a medical catastrophe. So there's a lot of Haitians that are in the medical field in the United States. So I thought I could be the first example coming down. Ever since I heard of the problem, on Tuesday night, I started working my contacts to try to get here.
How long are you here for?
2 weeks.
Would you recommend others come from the United States?
Yes. I heard that people were worrying about security, but it's not. You're here to help, you're gonna help people.
Dr. Marie-France Condé.
Tell us where you're from.
I'm from Brooklyn, New York. We have a lot of kids. Parents who've been here for 3-4 days, they are hungry. we finished with them. Some of them are ready to be discharged. Right now, we need someone to bring us some food so we can send them. Okay, we want to feed them. They are ready to be fed now. We cannot keep giving them IV fluids. That's the help that we need right now.
Do you think it's important that Haitians come back here?
Absolutely, absolutely. We want to make a difference, and we're hoping that this will open the eyes of everyone who truly wants to help us so we do have a better Haiti.
I'm Dr. Damour, and usually I work in Long Island. I work for the Catholic health system, and I came since Saturday. We flew from Saturday, and we started working on Monday. I came with the Haitian Medical Association aboard, and we came as a crew, and we have been seeing the terrible disaster, and we have been helping as best as we can. I'm a pediatrician, and this baby is about to go home now, and I'm going to do the final examination. But the other baby, there's some issue because the mother has no home, so we have to arrange some with the Red Cross to see where we can place the mother and the baby.
Souffre National.
She was in Fort National, and that is where the earthquake found her.
What's her baby's name?
Milo, my lord. My house is destroyed, and I'm not sure what I'm going to do. Marie, Kibolie, your husband, where is he? I haven't yet seen my husband.
What needs to happen now and what needs to happen for the next 200 years is that Haiti needs to be Haiti. Haiti needs to be allowed to rebuild. Haiti's been systematically destroyed by much of the world for the last 200 years. This aid attention is nice. The extra supplies are nice. The energy and the money is helpful. But if the Haitian institutions are not rebuilt, nothing will be durable, and in 1 year we'll be exactly where we are right now, which is in pain.
So we've come to the end of the hospital compound. It's the morgue. Until the last days, the bodies were piled here, 4 feet deep. Now they say they've taken all the bodies, not exactly clear where, but people are talking about mass graves. But the hope is the hospital. If people can survive, if people can get help, and we're talking about more than 1,500 people in the hospital, 1,000 waiting for surgery, and then in the Grand Plaza outside near the palace and the hospital, tens of thousands of people. The question of the restoration of Haiti lies here and lies in every home and community in Haiti. Even people who have healed enough to leave, who have recovered enough to go, the question is, what will happen to the mom who just gave birth to a little girl named Milord? She said she has nowhere to go. Or the doctor who told us what they need is food. We've got to send them out with something. That's the system that has to be worked. That's the question we leave this hospital with. I'm Amy Goodman in Port-au-Prince.
Special thanks to Elizabeth Press and Sharif Abdul-Quddus also for that report from the hospital in Port-au-Prince. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We have to go to break now, but we'll be back in a minute. Stay with us. Spirits Drifting by Brian Eno. Well, we're going to go back to Amy Goodman in Port-au-Prince. We reached her just before the broadcast. She was in an open field right next to the airport, where hundreds of relief and rescue workers have set up camp.
I'm standing here near the airport in Port-au-Prince. I can't exactly say my feet are firmly planted in the ground, because this morning, just about 6 o'clock, here in Port-au-Prince, we were in our room and just getting ready to leave for this broadcast. And the earth started to tremble. The floor, the walls, you feel the shake. It is that moment of just extreme panic when everyone in the house, everyone, starts running for their lives out of the house, making their way through rooms, jumping over, holding whatever it was you were holding at that moment. Outside, people hold each other, they weep, or they just breathe a sigh of relief, although not really, because you never know when the next aftershock will happen. And while our house still stood, what about others? Sometimes the earthquake, which destroyed so much of Haiti, can leave a house standing, but it only takes a lesser aftershock to take it down. So who got hurt this morning? Who was lost in the rubble? These are the questions we have every day. And as we walk down the streets of Port-au-Prince, seeing the bodies, the smell, the stench of death everywhere. Yesterday, the piece that we just brought you, the hospital. Across the street, the main pharmacy, where patients, where doctors go to get their drugs, is pancaked, is total rubble, and it was many floors. People were standing by. The way you know perhaps where bodies are buried, a pharmacist, a doctor, a nurse, a patient who'd come over, a customer, is you see the flies swarming over areas. There was a man laying on the street just across from the general hospital. And then when we looked carefully in the rubble, we could see another's head, and we could see the fingers that curling over a board as if the person was trying to get out. This is the face of Haiti. But right now, we're joined by Kim Ives. We've been traveling together. Kim writes for Haiti Liberté, and he's been working with us through this week. He's been living in Haiti for years, in and out, traveling in and out. Kim, I can't say welcome to Democracy Now! Since you've been with us all through this trip, but welcome to the broadcast of Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy.
Let's talk about this major catastrophe, this devastation. Now, of course, it's a natural catastrophe, but can you talk about how this catastrophe fits into Haiti? The level of destruction we're seeing today is not just about nature.
No, not at all. In fact, this earthquake was preceded by a political and economic earthquake with an epicenter 2,000 miles north of here in Washington, D.C., over the past 24 years. We can say, first of all, there was the case of the two coups d'etats held in the space of 13 years, in 91 and 2004, which were backed by the United States. They put in their own client regimes, which the Haitian people chased out of power. But these coups d'etats and subsequent occupations, foreign military occupations, in a country whose constitution forbids that, were fundamentally destructive not just to the national government and its national programs, but also to the local governments, so the parliaments, the mayor's offices, and also the local assemblies, which would elect a permanent electoral council. That permanent electoral council has never been made. It's a provisional, and hence Preval, and just before the earthquake, was running roughshod over popular democracy by putting his own electoral council in place, provisional, and they were bringing him and his party to domination of the political scene.
And just to be clear, when you talk about the two coups, the one in 1991, the one in 2004, both of them were the led to the ouster of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
Correct.
And you talked about U.S. involvement with those.
Right. And Aristide, in both cases, was taken from Haiti, essentially by U.S. forces both times. The first time he ended up spending it in Washington, but now he's presently in South Africa, where he's been for these past 6 years. But along with this political, these political earthquakes carried out by Washington were the economic earthquakes. The U.S. policy that they wanted to see in place, because Aristide's government had a fundamentally nationalist orientation, which was looking to build the national self-sufficiency of the country, but Washington would have none of it. They wanted the nine principal state publicly owned industries privatized to be sold to U.S. and foreign investors. So about 12 years ago, under the first administration of René Préval, they privatized the Minoterie d'Haïti and Ciment d'Haïti, the flour mill, the state flour mill, and the state cement company. Now, for flour, obviously you have a hungry, needy population. You can imagine if the state had a robust flour mill where it could distribute flour to the people so they could have bread. That was sold to a company of which Henry Kissinger was a board member. And very quickly, that flour mill was closed. Haiti now has no flour mill, not private or public.
Where does it get its flour? This is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere.
It has to import it, and a lot of it is coming from the United States. The other one is, and even more ironic, Amy, is the cement factory. Here is a country which is mostly made of limestone, geologically, and that is the foundation of cement. It is a country which absolutely should and could have a cement company, and did, but it was again privatized and immediately shut down, and they began using the docks of the cement company for importing cement. So when we drive around this country and we see the thousands of cement buildings which are pancaked or collapsed, this is a country which is going to need millions and millions of tons of cement, and it's going to have to now import all of that cement rather than being able to produce it itself. It could be and should be an exporter of cement, not an importer.
We're talking to Kim Ives of Haiti Liberté, who also just put out another issue of Haiti Liberté here in the aftermath of the earthquake. You talked about the cement company, the flour company, privatization. You know, one of the most painful problems now, especially for the Haitian diaspora, and for people who have overall loved ones here in Haiti, is that they haven't been able to find out if they're alive. Right. They haven't been able to communicate with them. And right. This goes to the telephone company.
Exactly. Teleco was the crown jewel of the Haitian state industries. During the first coup d'etat from 91 to 94, it was, in fact, the revenues from Teleco that sustained the government in exile of President Aristide. And now we see today, 1 week before this earthquake, the telephone company Teleco was privatized. It was sold to a Vietnamese company, Viettel. And if we had in this country a robust, agile, nimble national telephone company, a lot of the problems of communication could have been avoided. Instead, all the communications today are practically in the hands of the three private cell companies, Digicel, Voila, and Hitel.
But those, some people might say, well, if it was just sold a week before, then that's, the fact that it was weak was due to the previous owner.
No, it was, that's precisely the case. It was the Haitian government who was, in fact, with the leadership of René Préval and his prime ministers, who were undermining and sabotaging. We spoke over the years. I remember 13 years ago, we were doing a delegation here to talk to the unionists. That's how long this struggle against privatization has been going. We were speaking to the unionists at the telephone company, at Teleco, a certain Jean Mabou. And Jean Mabou, the union leader, took us to a room where it was filled with new, brand new, modern telecommunications equipment, boards, all sorts of things. He said, we've got these, and they won't allow us to install them. They are deliberately undermining the state company so they can sell it. And this is the irony, is that you have the fox guarding the chicken coop, and the people are in that way undermined in their ownership of their own state companies.
Kim, you know, unfortunately, at times like these, in global catastrophes, that's when the world pays attention. And in this case, it's attention to Haiti. You started in 1991 with the two coups against Aristide, a very brief thumbnail history of Haiti, going back to 1804, if you will.
Okay, thumbnail. 1804, the first and last slave revolution in history, the first black republic in the world, the first independent nation of Latin America, which became the touchstone of all the other revolutions. It wasn't until 60 years later that it was recognized by the government of Abraham Lincoln after the Civil War. Then, in 1915, U.S. Marines invaded the country and took control of the bank, took control of the government. They stayed there for 19 years, till 1934. After that, they put in place an outfit called the Garde d'Haïti, the Guard of Haiti, which acted as a proxy force to maintain U.S. interests in Haiti. And then that finally gave birth in 1957 to the dictatorship of François Papadoc Duvalier. He became president for life, passed on his title of president for life to his son, Jean-Claude Duvalier, when he died in 1971.
And the role of U.S. in that?
And the U.S. was essentially supporting those governments all the time for geopolitical reasons. Haiti was the principal bulwark against the eastward push of quote-unquote communism coming from neighboring Cuba. And so, therefore, the Duvalier regimes, hugely unpopular, were propped up, given military support by and economic cooperation from the United States.
A kleptocracy, the dictators getting richer and the people getting poorer.
Exactly. And then in 1986, they started to see that this particular paradigm was creating too many Che Guevaras, too many revolutions in Latin America, and they switched over to these facade elections of putting supposedly democratic leaders in, but they were purchased elections. Haiti was the first country in Latin America to foil this U.S. engineered election scenario by electing a poor parish priest, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, to the presidency. And at the time of his inauguration on February 7, 1991, he declared the second independence of Haiti, because Haiti was going to become independent of the imperial domination of the United States and France. And they quickly responded with a coup d'etat 8 months later. He was sent into exile. And again, the earthquakes centered in Washington and Paris of the past 24 years began.
So you have the first coup against Aristide. He's kept out for 3 years. The coup happened under George H.W. Bush, but continued through President Clinton. By the way, one of the major platforms of President Aristide when he first came to power was to increase the minimum wage. The second time he was elected in 2004, immediately pushed out, taken out by U.S. military and security. This was a story Democracy Now! Listeners and viewers might remember well, because I followed a delegation to the Central African Republic where he and Mildred Aristide were dumped, were essentially being held. And Maxine Waters, Congress member from Los Angeles, Randall Robinson, founder of TransAfrica, I covered them going to the Central African Republic, and they brought back the Aristides to this hemisphere nearby Jamaica. Ultimately, they ended up in South Africa, where they are today. They could not come back to this country. Tremendous pressure from the United States, the officials. It was Secretary of State Colin Powell at the time, Condoleezza Rice, saying he was not to return to this hemisphere. Now, from exile in South Africa, President Aristide held a news conference. He issued a statement saying he wants to return. I've put this question to a number of people here in Haiti. In Washington, President Obama immediately appointed President Clinton and President George W. Bush to spearhead the fundraising effort to help the people of Haiti. Three presidents, a united front, saying this is not partisan. And so here in Haiti, the question of Aristide's return now—I mean, the U.S. controls the airport. Prime Minister Preval ceded the control of the airport to the United States. But Aristide has asked to return. What about that image of, not to mention the resources of, Prime Minister Preval, Prime Minister, previous Prime Minister Aristide, both presidents, rather, standing together and saying, this is beyond politics. We have to rebuild our country.
Well, that's exactly it. I was standing in front of the General Hospital yesterday after we went through and saw the horrors there, and I was speaking to a crowd of people outside on the corner, and that very question came up. Why can't President Aristide come back? He wants to. He has said so. The government hasn't given or renewed his diplomatic passport, which has expired. They haven't given him a laissez-passer to come to the country. That's all that's needed. If the government of Barack Obama or any other government wanted to really provide support here, even maybe more than all the C-130s we see offloading, not just food and medical supplies, but guns and lots of them, this would be to send a plane to South Africa and bring Aristide here. It would create such a tremendous groundswell, a counter-earthquake, if you will, of popular hope and pride and victory, that it would go a long way to rebuilding the necessary moral ballast needed to weather the storm.
Well, Kim Ives, I want to thank you very much for being with us and ask one last question, and that's about popular organizations in this country. Who has the power here? How are people organizing? This whole issue of security that has been raised over and over again to explain why aid hasn't come from this area, where in the area of the airport, where there is so much aid that has been stockpiled and gone out to communities. So why the UN has said, for example, Laogan, epicenter of the earthquake, that they would only come there after they could guarantee security.
Like you said, Amy, this is the nub of the question. Security is not the issue. We see throughout Haiti the population themselves organizing themselves into popular committees to clean up, to pull out the bodies from the rubble, to build refugee camps, to set up their security for the refugee camps. This is a population which is self-sufficient, and it has been self-sufficient for all these years. It's not now that a bunch of Marines have to come in with big M16s and start yelling at them. Watching the scene in front of the General Hospital yesterday said it all. Here were people who were going in and out of the hospital, bringing food to their loved ones in there or needing to go to the hospital, and there were a bunch of U.S. 82nd Airborne soldiers in front, yelling in English at this crowd. They didn't know what they were doing. They were creating more chaos rather than diminishing it. It was a comedy if it weren't so tragic. Here is, they had no business being there. Sure, if there's some way where you have an army of bandits, which we haven't seen on any mass scale, going and attacking, maybe you might bring in some guys like that. But right now, people don't need guns. They need gauze, as I think one a doctor put it. And this is the essence of, it's just the same way they reacted after Katrina. It's the same way they acted. The victims are what's scary. They're the other. They're black people who, you know, had the only successful slave revolution in history. What could be more threatening?
And the community organizations in place.
Oh, and the community organizations. We saw it the other night up at Matthew 25, where we're staying. The community, a truckload of food came in the middle of the night, unannounced. It could have been a melee. The local popular organization, Pity Drop, was contacted. They immediately mobilized their members. They came out. They set up a perimeter. They set up a cordon. They lined up about 600 people who are staying on the soccer field behind the house, which is also a hospital. And they distributed the food in an orderly, equitable fashion. They were totally sufficient. They didn't need Marines. They didn't need the UN. They didn't need any of these things, which we're being told also in the press and by Hillary Clinton and the all foreign ministers that they need. These are things that people can do for themselves and are doing for themselves.
Kim Ives, thanks very much. Kim Ives writes for Haiti Liberté. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Je suis sûre de sa parole. Je mets mon espoir dans le Seigneur. Je suis sûre de sa parole. Des profondeurs, je crie vers toi, Seigneur. Seigneur, écoute mon appel. Fasse attentive au cri de ma prière. Je mets mon espoir dans le Seigneur.
Prayers for Haiti from the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. And Amy Goodman filed those reports earlier in the broadcast from Port-au-Prince, where a powerful aftershock measuring 6.1 on the Richter scale just hit the Haitian capital. We still don't know the extent of the damage or deaths from this aftershock, the strongest yet since the earthquake last week. We'll continue to have reports from Haiti tomorrow. Well, a year ago today, President Obama was inaugurated in front of hundreds of thousands of supporters in Washington, D.C. 2 days later, he signed executive orders outlawing torture and vowed to close Guantanamo within a year. A year later, Guantanamo remains open and the White House is facing accusations that it has covered up the possible murder of three prisoners at the U.S. military prison in Guantanamo. An explosive story has just been published in Harper's Magazine. It's titled The Guantanamo Suicides, A Camp Delta Sergeant Blows the Whistle. The story focuses on the night of June 9, 2006, when three prisoners, two from Saudi Arabia and one from Yemen, died at the base. Authorities at Guantanamo said the three men, Yasser Talal al-Zahrani, Salah Ahmed al-Salami and Mani Shaman al-Utaybi, had killed themselves. The commander at Guantanamo, Rear Admiral Harry Harris, described their deaths as a, quote, act of asymmetrical warfare waged against us.
Smart, they are creative, they are committed. They have no regard in life, neither ours nor their own. I believe this was not an act of desperation, but rather an act of asymmetric warfare waged against us.
But new evidence has emerged suggesting the men died not from suicide, but torture. A six-month investigation by Harper's Magazine indicates the three prisoners were suffocated and tortured during questioning at a secret black site facility at Guantanamo known as Camp No. The article is based in part on testimony from former Staff Sergeant Joe Hickman, who was on duty on the night of June 9, 2006. Last February, Hickman approached the Justice Department after President Obama was elected, but an investigation into his claims was shelved. For more on the story, we're joined by the author of the article, Scott Horton. He's an attorney, international law expert, and a contributor to Harper's Magazine. Scott Horton, welcome to Democracy Now! Explain the story. What happened? How did you find out these were not suicides?
Well, you know, we should start just by noting the official story that was finally put forward by the government of how they died, because we hear Admiral Harris saying asymmetrical warfare, they committed suicide. There was never any detail spread out on the record at the outset. By piecing together very carefully the official NCIS investigation report, which was released, is the Naval Criminal Investigation Service, we were able to see how they had concluded the suicides occurred. And they state that these three prisoners bound their feet, bound their hands with cloth, stuffed cloth down their throats, in some cases at least, put masks over their faces to hold the cloth in place, fashioned mannequins of themselves to put in their beds to deceive the guards, put up cloth to obstruct the view of cameras, fashioned a noose which they attached at the top of an 8-foot wire wall, stepped up as their hands and feet are bound and they're gagging on cloth, stepped up on top of a wash basin, put their head through the noose, tightened it, and jumped off. And moreover, that these three prisoners in non-adjacent cells did all of these things absolutely simultaneously in a clockwork-like fashion. So the story is just simply incredible. And simply not believable, I should stress. We began looking at autopsy evidence, all sorts of other evidence, which strongly suggested that there was something seriously inappropriate here. We talked with pathologists and so on, who told us they'd rarely seen something quite as irregular as what was going on here. I was approached by Sergeant Hickman, who gave me his account. And it's not just Sergeant Hickman, actually. It's almost his entire unit who was on duty that night in the perimeter guards. Four other soldiers provided aspects of corroboration. There's not a single element of Sergeant Hickman's story that is not, in fact, corroborated by others based on their own eyewitness testimony. And I should say, the things they observe are the things they were required to observe. It was their duty. These were the perimeter guards. They were supposed to keep close count of everything that happened, and particularly who went in and out of the base that evening. And what they tell us is that three prisoners were removed from that cell block that evening between 7 and 8 o'clock and taken to the secret facility, Camp No.
Explain what Camp No is. Why is it called Camp No?
Well, they call it Camp No because no, it does not exist was an answer that they were supposed to give if there were inquiries about it. They had, in their first weeks on the job there in March 2006, they had come across it when they were doing perimeter patrols. In fact, two of the soldiers here were PIs, and they decided sort of to sharpen their skills. They were going to monitor and keep an eye on Camp No, which they did. And they largely believed that this was a facility that was being used by the CIA or certainly by intelligence service agents. They noted ununiformed government personnel from other government agencies who seemed to be involved with or connected with this facility.
And Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, might have also been involved?
Absolutely. There's quite a bit of evidence suggesting that JSOC and CIA are working together in these efforts.
Can you explain exactly what Joe Hickman told you? What was his account? What happened the night of June 9th, 2006?
He was the sergeant of the guard that night. He was on duty. He came on duty a little bit after 6. At 7 o'clock, he saw a vehicle that was called the paddy wagon that was used strictly for detainee transportation. Pull up next to Camp 1. He saw a prisoner emerge from Camp 1, was loaded into the back of the paddy wagon. Now, they were under strict instructions that the movements of this paddy wagon with prisoners were never to be recorded, nor were they to ask anything or identify the people who were on board. So he thought that was fine. It took off. He saw it make the turn and head in the direction of this camp. Then within 20 minutes, exactly enough time to make the trip to Camp No and return, the van was there a second time, picking up a second prisoner. And in 20 minutes again, a third prisoner. Well, a third time, he'd never seen so much activity in close confines occur. He went out to the outermost perimeter checkpoint to follow exactly where this van was going. And he saw that, in fact, it was going to Camp No. There's no question about that. So we know by 8 o'clock, these three prisoners from Camp 1, and we have only three prisoners who are unaccounted for, the three who died by the end of that evening, have been delivered to Camp No. He also noted then that after 11 o'clock, that same van was pulled up in front of the detainee medical facility, backed up as if to unload something. And it's shortly after that that the first signs appeared that there were three dead prisoners. Also, other guards, not Sergeant Hickman, kept a close watch on the connections between Camp 1 and the detainee medical facility. The official report says that they were found in their cells. They were taken out and dropped at this medical facility. Well, there's an alleyway that's under tight observation by two towers at opposite ends of it. And the guards who were on duty at those two towers confirmed to me that there was no movement of any prisoner, whether on a gurney or a stretcher or any other way, from Camp 1 to the detainee medical facility that night. So the claims that they were found in their cells and taken to the facility, no.
Explain what happened when their bodies were found. What state were their bodies in?
Well, the bodies were reportedly found at about 12:30, and the medical examination showed that they had been dead for at least 2 hours at that point. So the pathologists are putting the time of death at, say, roughly between 10 and 10:30, sometime in that time frame.
And how did the commanders at the base react?
The commanders reacted. We know that Colonel Baumgartner rushed to the scene, arriving there shortly before 1 o'clock, long after all this activity is over. And the next morning, the guards are assembled in Camp America Theater, an open area, and they're told that, look, many of you know that these prisoners died, or actually, he said, we all know that these prisoners died by having rags stuffed down their throats. But tomorrow, the press is going to be broadcasting a different story. The story that will run is that they committed suicide by hanging themselves in their cells, and you may not contradict or undermine that in any way. You should not talk about what you saw or observed. And they reminded them that their telephones and their email communications were being monitored.
After your piece was published on Tuesday, Colonel Baumgartner, the former commander, sent an email to the Associated Press. It read, quote, "This blatant misrepresentation of the truth infuriates me. I don't know who Sergeant Hickman is, but he's only trying to be a spotlight ranger. He knows nothing about what transpired in Camp 1 or our medical facility. I do. I was there." Your response?
I think Colonel Baumgartner has a real problem right now. And we'll just start with the last part. I do. I was there. Either he lied to the Associated Press or he lied to the naval criminal investigators, because he gave them a sworn statement, which includes the words, I was not at the camp that night, the night of 09 June 06. He says, in fact, he was at the social function and the quarters of Admiral Harris. And he goes on to say he came to the camp a little bit before 1 o'clock on the 10th of June, which, of course, is long after all these events had transpired. Beyond that, he says, I do not know Sergeant Hickman. That's also demonstrably false. In fact, he was so impressed with the way Sergeant Hickman had handled defusing the prison riot on May 18th, which was probably, other than these suicides, the most dramatic event that occurred on his watch, that he put him up for a medal and awarded the medal to him. And there's quite a bit of other evidence of their direct relationships. That's just not a true statement. And the beginning statement is a non-denial denial. He doesn't actually deny anything.
Scott, we just have a minute left. Talk about the role of the Justice Department in the cover-up and where the Obama administration is on this, what's happened over the past year.
Well, maybe that's the most distressing single element other than the deaths themselves. The Justice Department is intimately involved in covering up these crimes from the first days after they occur. FBI is deployed to intimidate people not to speak about what's going on. Justice Department is then filing papers with federal judges in which it makes apparently false statements about everything that went on here. And then when the Obama administration is notified about this, they engage in a further cover-up, claiming to conduct an investigation. But we know from the course of it that they concluded that they would not open a criminal investigation before they even contacted the critical witnesses here. Cover-up after cover-up. And Barack Obama is not upholding the pledge he made when he received the Nobel Prize to enforce the Geneva Conventions.
And these three men were about to be released. They were slated for release.
All three
10
of
seconds.
Them, yes. It had been concluded that none of them were al-Qaeda or Taliban fighters. And in fact, the Bush administration had decided to release all three of them.
Well, that's all we have time for. Scott Horton, contributing editor to Harper's Magazine. The latest piece is called Guantanamo Suicides. I'm Anjali Kamath. You're watching Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Thanks for watching.